Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, you're listening to Tax Tuesday. This is Toby Mathis.
And Jeff Webb.
And we are bringing tax knowledge to the masses, one listener at a time. Used to be a guy in Seattle that would say that, but he wouldn't say the thing about the tax. He would just say he's bringing drive-by wisdom. All right, so let's see. We have a whole bunch of people on. We like that. The more the merrier for us. And our staffing, we have the ability to answer all your questions. So we have Matthew, Patty, Susan on, but we also have a bunch of tax professionals. Christos is on, Elliot, tax attorney, Pio, another accountant, and Tavia, bookkeeper. So we have a good crew. Jeff is a CPA, I'm an attorney. We never even say that. It just kind of goes without saying. And so we will answer your questions. So ask away. When you're doing this, we'll just kind of go through the rules. Ask you in the Q&A feature in Zoom, because if it's in the chat, it's just going to fly right by us because there's so many people. Is that Jeff Webb from Dragnet?
No, that would be my dad, Jack.
Jack. Anyway, hey, there's some people from different areas. We never get to ask this on Tax Tuesday, but so I'm going to ask it. Where are you guys all from? Because we have so many people that join this. It's usually just a brrrr, but put it into the chat. Some of you guys already put it into the question. California. Where in California? Raleigh, San Jose, Colorado Springs, San Francisco, something, New York City, Oak Hills, Chicago, Orlando, Dallas, Tucson, Houston, New Jersey, Lancaster, Oklahoma, Sedona, Santa Fe, San Antonio, Kapolei, there's Mark, I always know it's him. I'll go from Seattle, Woodside, Chicago, Long Beach, Tacoma Park, Maryland, Las Vegas, that's where we're at. Incline Village, Honolulu, you're making me jealous. Utah, Twin Cities, Livingston, Saratoga Springs, Spokane, Denver, New Jersey, Boston, New York, Washington State. Look at this. So we have a lot of folks from all over the country. And feel free, Minnesota. There we go. So guys, thanks for letting us know. That's really awesome. And Maine, oh my gosh, that's where... Denise is one of our employees, actually, lives up there. So that's always fun to see just how diverse a group we always have. So, but we'll just jump right on in. First off, if you have any questions, feel free to send them to Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. That's where we pick the questions that we answer on this. And we also answer your questions regardless, as long as it's a general question. If you start asking us about a bunch of questions on your tax return, we're going to make you engage us, but otherwise we'll just answer. It's supposed to be fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help to educate people. Jeff, you probably didn't experience this, but I was an idiot with taxes. When I became an attorney, it was embarrassing. I didn't know anything about them. I remember the first time I filed a tax return on my business when I was still in high school, and I sent all my receipts in. I was like, I was sure that they wanted to see my receipts. So I sent my tax return in with a big old box of all the receipts off of my little painting company. So it's kind of fun. So I just want to help people. So you're not like me at that point. There's a lot of tax knowledge that we can help get out there and hopefully demystify it and make it less scary, so people realize how empowered they are in the tax world. Is that fair? Yeah,
no, that is. A little knowledge goes a long way. Just certain misconceptions you may have, hopefully we clarify. Buy those and clear things up for you.
Such a CPA. What? Can you hear that? I was whispering. All right. We are concerned about, these are the questions that we're going to answer today, by the way. So just bear with us as we lay them out. We are concerned about how to protect our tax deferral for capital gains and how to separate the LLC that we own with another partner so that each can be protected from capital gains at this time. The other partner owns 43.2%. We have a basis of approximately $165,000 with a potential value at sale of $1 million. Nice. We would like to divide this so we could each invest in multiple assets without paying capital gains in this time. Both partners want to diversify, but separately. What are our options? There are none. No, I'm just kidding. We'll answer that. See, I just take their joy away. Oh my God, you did that? That's what I always love it when accountants do. They look at you, what did you do? Please talk about being a real estate professional. What are the requirements and the benefits? I have fully depreciated rental property in a high tax state. Can I do a 1031 exchange and buy some farmland in a different state, not pay taxes to the high tax state? Good question. In fact, we'll pretend that high tax state is California, and we'll use that as an example. All right. I recently bought a security that I'm bullish on in the long term, but it has taken a hit recently. I also sold some real estate this year and realized capital gains on them. If I sold the security and replaced at a lower price, could I lock in a loss to offset the capital gains in real estate? Are there any rules about the timing of this transaction? All right. So that will answer that one. That'll be fun. See, now you're, this is like accountant crack. So all the accountants out there are going, oh. All right. I have an escort business. I hired my 12-year-old son to work, and he gets a W-2 with annual income of about $1,400. Should he need to file a tax return? How about should he file a tax? I love, like, I just grab these and I never proof them or anything. I just like, should he need? Oh, that's interesting. I like the words, but it's a lot of them. If he does not file a tax return, will that increase my chances of getting an audit for my business? I don't know. We'll answer it. Can I write off my monthly car payment if it's financed and in my corporation's name? Great question. We'll knock that one out too. I have a rental property that is owned by a self-directed IRA. Does it need to be in an entity or is it safe in the IRA? So we will get that for sure. We'll go through all these. Oh, good questions. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I stopped myself. I had like four or five more. And then I thought of Jeff going, are we really going to like 4:30, 5 o'clock again? Right. Say I have 10 properties, single family homes, all under my name. I want to get a portfolio loan to include them all under the same loan, but I also want to put them under an LLC's protection and not my name. If I separate the properties into several different LLCs, can I still put them under the same portfolio loan? Great question. On a subject to deal, who pays capital gains and pays the depreciation recapture? Assume the owner granted the deed to the subject to buyer. I guess they want to make sure. Great question. So good questions today. Interesting. And I like to pick them because there are oftentimes there's some points that we can make with them. Sometimes I just grab them, but I like to see what, if there's some learning that we can do together on it. So this will be fun.
But I do like how you make it really dramatic in the intro and then we go to commercial.
Really?
And then come back. And
we should. We're going to start having commercials. Who would advertise on this? Like, I can't even imagine it. Oh, I want to advertise on a tax program. A pencil company. A pencil company might want to. All right. We are concerned a cat company, because I imagine accountants like cats. All right. We are concerned about how to protect our tax deferral for capital gains and how to separate the LLC that we own with another partner so that each can be protected from capital gains tax at this time. So the other owner. So let's just say Jeff and I are owning. I'm in it, 67% or 68.8 or whatever it is. And Jeff has 43.2. We have a basis of 165, but we're going to sell it and there's going to be $1 million. We would like to divide this each so we can invest in multiple assets without paying capital gains. Both partners want to diversify, but separately, what are the options? What do you think, Jeff?
Well, assuming that this is real estate we're talking about, you actually have two choices. You can do the 1031 exchange, which means you sell your property through a qualified intermediary. And then purchase new properties to replace.
Mm-hmm. But there's rules on that, right?
There is rules on that. There's rules on how many properties you can use to replace.
But doesn't it have to be name to name? Like if you and I are like, hey, we had a good run, we made some money, but you want to do your thing, I want to do my thing.
So both the problem with the 1031 and the other one, the qualified opportunity zone, is it does have to go from name to name.
I don't think the QAS does.
You don't think it does?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
So in a qualified opportunity zone, you're putting your money in a qualified opportunity zone fund and you're saying, hey, these are capital gains and they've allowed under the regs to put in the depreciation. So all the gain and you're deferring it.
So yeah, you're right about that, because it's your capital gains and being a partner in this partnership.
Yep. And so what it comes down to is, like, in this particular case, we have a partner in a partnership. So their taxes would be due, April 15th, but their tax year end would have been December. And those individuals are allowed to use that as their starting point to put the money into a qualified opportunity fund. And then that qualified opportunity fund needs to put its money into qualified opportunity zone property within a set period of time too. It's basically, you have a year between the two, but you want to make sure that you're doing that. But when you have a partnership, you actually have a longer period of time to put it in. Whereas if I sold something in my name, I would have it 180 days from that point. So this is actually a pretty good scenario. The reason I was picking on you on the 1031 exchange is because you have to go name to name. So you have to go LLC. Let's say we have an LLC, and I kind of assume from this that we're talking about real estate too. If this is stock, then this is off the table.
Right.
If it's stock, you can still do qualified opportunity zone, and you can absolutely defer. The other thing you do is, before you sell it, just give it all away, like give your interest away and sell it through a charity if you felt like it. And there's some other things you could do, or if this was an LLC, it depends on who the owner is. If it's an IRA or 401k, then you don't really have to worry. But let's assume this is real estate. I think that's the correct reading of this question. And we have depreciation recapture, depending on how long they owned it. It looks like probably for quite a while. And they have long-term capital gains. And you can roll basis into new property acquired by that same LLC. Now, there's something called a swap and drop that you could potentially do, which means somebody agrees to go, hey, I'm going to keep this LLC. We're going to acquire new properties, and I'm going to buy you out of your interest. And I may be buying you out of your interest with property. So it depends on what they're doing. It may be an interest in the property. I believe you could do that to avoid tax entirely without a deferral, because, like, in the qualified opportunity zone fund, you're going to have a tax hit in 2026. I believe it is 5 years from now. So you're just deferring those capital gains. Here, if I did a 1031 exchange, I'm just rolling it into new property. I could do a bunch of properties, right?
Yeah.
So I hope we didn't just confuse you. Felt like I just made a word salad and dipped it in some.
Yeah. If you do want to do a straight 1031 exchange, you do have to do it within your LLC.
Yep.
Say you buy several other properties or different kinds of properties, you're going to establish their basis. At that time, after the purchase of new properties, there's no reason why you couldn't distribute those properties out to the partners individually. Say, I want the apartment building and you take the two single family homes.
There's really not much on there. Like, there's not going to be, again, I think that there's swap and drops, drop and swap. The swap and drop is when you complete the 1031 exchange, and then you buy out a partner, usually by returning their monies. But if you distribute an asset inside the partnership, then they would just receive it at the basis. So it'd probably go LLC to LLC with the owners breaking up their interests. Yeah. And so that it's the correct proportionate amount. Right? That's the hard part. Try to think if there's anything else you could do on that. No, so they're going to sell it for $1 million. Unless they have a bunch of cash in there too, then it makes it simple. You can say, oh, here's your portion, here's some extra cash to make sure that you got an interest.
One other thing I thought about on this is you could actually do a combination of 1031 and qualified opportunity zone.
Absolutely, yeah. So those are the ways, the big deferral ways are opportunity zones and 1031. 1031 is an indefinite deferral. Qualified opportunity zone is a 5-year deferral right now, or you could put it into a charity or your own foundation, that type of thing, and avoid the tax entirely and try to get a tax write-off. And then we're not worried, as long as you're not trying to get back to the asset. You want that asset back, you're paying ordinary income on it by paying it out to yourself. But that's not why you do charities.
Right.
Charities to do good and give it away. All right. Please talk about being a real estate professional. What are the requirements and the benefits?
I'll start with the benefits. The benefits are, it allows you to write off losses that you normally wouldn't be able to write off just as a landlord.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of different types of income. So, like, if you have ordinary income, active income, think of sweat of your brow, I work my butt off, I run a, you know, plumbing company, and I, you know, that's ordinary income. That's, you know, hey, I get a W-2 income. That's ordinary income. So wages and things like that. Then you have passive income, and there's only two types: real estate and businesses in which you do not materially participate. And the rub is losses on those real estate and businesses in which you do not materially participate. So your silent partner in a business is the losses from those businesses can only be used to offset other passive income. So it kind of sucks. So I have a bunch of real estate and I have lots of depreciation. Maybe I accelerate it. I'm all excited and I'm like, oh, I learned this, that I can accelerate it. And I got a $100,000 loss. Oh boy, I'm not going to pay tax this year. And then Jeff goes up and says, well, you're going to have a loss carry forward because we can't use those passive losses against your active income. And of course, then the question immediately to Jeff is, really? I didn't know that. What are the exceptions? And Jeff says, oh, well, if you're an active participant, you get a $25,000 limit. So if you have a $100,000 loss and you made $100,000, you would take $25,000 of that $100,000 each year for the next 4 years, and you would pay, basically, you'd pay tax on $75,000. And then the other one, Jeff says, well, if you're a real estate professional, either you or your spouse, then it unlocks the entire amount of that loss, and you can use it to offset your entire ordinary income, in which case you would pay no taxes in that year. I don't even think that's the best idea, by the way. Okay. Like, you want to lower your taxes? If I'm underneath 20%, I'm okay. There might be one other way to do it. One other benefit, real estate professional, is if you're going to group up your activities, if I'm going to accelerate depreciation, now I have a lot of control over my income, but that's really it. And what are the requirements? You want to go over the requirements of real estate professional?
I'll give you a couple definite fails. If you are working full-time, or you and your spouse are both working full-time, if you're married, you're probably going to fail this test. There is the, what is it, the 200-hour requirement? No, the 500-hour requirement.
750. So actually, let me give you guys a site so that you have some fun. You can go read. Oops. Here I thought I was going to be able to draw. I need to be able to draw. 469C7. That's it, right? 26 USC. So that's the actual code provision. And to be a real estate professional, you have the first test is 750 hours and greater than 50% of your personal services for either spouse. So this is a either spouse. So what Jeff was saying about two spouses, if both spouses work full time, mm-hmm. it's going to be almost impossible to exceed 50, to have more than 50% of your time on real estate.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be your real estate. This test is in buying and selling real estate. So a real estate agent, development, construction, if you're involved in, like, you run a company that does construction, general contractor, you do driveways, whatever it is, so long as it's real estate, then you're going to absolutely avoid, like, you're going to get that benefit. You're going to be able to hit the 750 hours, so long as you don't do something more than that activity.
Yep.
So if you're full-time, Jeff's a full-time accountant, and let's say he does 2,000 hours a year as an accountant, he would have to hit 2,001 hours as in real estate.
Right. Yep.
Crazy. It's not going to happen, right? But let's say that Jeff did part-time accountant work, and let's say he did 800 hours a year as an accountant, but he did 801 hours as a real estate actor. You know, he did his construction on the side. He would qualify for this first prong. So that's prong number one. Prong number two is you materially participate. And that's a term of art in your real estate activities. So that's a big one. You have to, there's like, what, 9 tests?
Yes.
And so what I spent, somebody says 750 hours combined between my wife and myself. No, one of them has to hit that first prong. Prong two is both spouses combined. So in test number one, either spouse has to hit that 750 hours greater than 50% of their personal services. Prong number two is you look at the spouses together. Did you materially participate in your properties? And it's per property, unless, what do you have to do?
Say that again.
It's per property, material participation.
Oh, okay. Unless you make a aggregation election.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you're saying all of my properties are one property.
Do accountants forget to do the aggregation election?
Yeah, they do.
Yep. And they end up becoming great tax cases because that's all the cases. It's like, oh, you did 750 hours, but you had 3 properties and you didn't elect to aggregate them. So which property did you do the 750 hours on? Well, it was all three of them together. You don't qualify now.
Right.
Yeah, for any of them, because you didn't do 750. Like, gets silly, right? So the best example I can give you is, let's say that Jeff and I are married, and Jeff is working his katush off. This is great. So I like older men. So Jeff is the CPA. He's making lots of money. And we'll just pretend, Jeff. And I go out and I'm doing real estate. Jeff makes a whole bunch of money. I go out and I do real estate. And together, we create this big, you know, this real estate empire. And it's generating losses. So Jeff, let's say, makes $500,000 a year. And I create a loss of $250,000 because of depreciation. Maybe I accelerate the depreciation, whatever. I can use the $250,000. We can use the $250,000 on our return to offset the income.
Now, there are a couple of times I don't recommend doing the real estate professional. If you have existing properties that have significant passive losses that have been suspended.
Yeah, so go over that one. That's a huge one.
I have, say, three properties, and between the three of them, they have $250,000 worth of passive losses that have been suspended. Mm-hmm. That is, I couldn't take them in the past, so they just keep rolling forward. Once I become a real estate professional, those losses get locked in. Normally, when you sell a property, you release those passive losses.
Mm-hmm.
But once you make that aggregation election, you have to sell substantially all of your properties to be able to release those losses.
Mm-hmm. So that's the one downside, is if you have a big loss carry forward, you wouldn't want to aggregate all your properties. You'd want to make sure that if you have a big loss carry forward, probably not horribly worried about the aggregation at that time. We'd have to take a look at it, make sure that you don't do a face plant. Somebody says, if I'm retired, can I take care of my own properties? Yeah, maturely participate. You can do it without an hour limitation if you self-manage. If you do manage properties, as long as nobody spends more than 100 hours on your properties, then you can do it with 100 hours, as long as you spend the most time. If you do have other people spending more than 100 hours, then you have to hit 500 hours. There's a few other minor tests about prior inclusion, like if you've been a real estate professional mm-hmm. for so many years, then it kind of works. And somebody asked about the net investment income tax. Does real estate professional affect the NIT at all?
Real estate professionals are not subject to NIT.
Yep. So if you're a real estate professional and you make a whole bunch of money, now we're not worried about the loss, but we are looking at it saying, hey, you don't have the net investment income tax on that income.
Right.
Yeah. So somebody nailed that. Where do you aggregate the properties?
It's actually election fill out. It's not a form. It's just a statement that gets included with your return. And once you make that election, it's usually irrevocable. But say I make the election, I have two properties and I buy two more properties, those automatically get collected in under the aggregation rules.
Okay. Somebody has a good question. As a W-2 employee in construction, can I qualify as a real estate professional? Unfortunately, in order for you to qualify, you'd have to be a greater than 5% owner of a business in which you work. So if you have your own company, it's easy. If you work for somebody else, as long as you're a 5% or greater owner, then you can. Can I do it if I'm retired? Yes.
Retired is actually a great time to do it.
Yeah, because it's...
The material participation rules are pretty easy to meet.
Yep. It's not hard. And then it will offset any of the forced income you have from your IRAs or 401ks, et cetera. All right. Questions. We like to stop and look at the computer screens. I've already been looking at it. Somebody says, do you need a qualified intermediary? What if you're using a real estate attorney? They have to be a qualified intermediary, right? There's actually a designation.
Right. And what happens is the QI, the qualified intermediary,
mm-hmm.
they handle the entire sale. The proceeds go to them, not to you. Once you touch the cash, your 1031 is dead in the water.
Yeah, and somebody's asking about referrals to one. I have a really good one out in Idaho. It always depends on where their registrations and licensing is. So I'm always shocked. So you can absolutely use somebody as a qualified intermediary in multiple states. But there's lots of exchange companies. You just want to talk to somebody. This is somebody. Somebody says, have you had any clients take advantage of the tax haven benefits of Puerto Rico? Yes. We have quite a few that move there and set it up because the long-term capital gains or capital gains in general and dividends are taxed at zero. You have to spend at least 180 days on the island actually physically on the island, and you have to have a business that employs, I want to say, one or two people. Do you know the, do you remember all that?
I do not know the exact rule, but yes.
Yeah. So there's, it's a little more than just moving there. But if you do that, then you get what, the 4% tax rate and zero tax rate on dividends and capital gains, which is why some people choose to shoot on over there. Once you aggregate multiple parties, do you have to sell them together? Do you have to sell them all at the same time, or do you just sell them one at a time?
You can sell them off piecemeal, but if I sell one of my five properties, I'm not going to be able to release any losses I have.
Your loss carryforwards are what Jeff's talking about. So you always look and say, do I have loss carryforwards?
Alternatively, if I start buying properties today and become a real estate professional this year, I won't have any suspended losses. Mm-hmm. By being a real estate professional, I'll be able to take those losses every year.
I'm trying to write Puerto Rico. Let's see. Beautiful island. Let's see. See, I'm answering questions while you're talking. Let's see what else. When do you have to qualify as a professional? The year the loss was incurred or the year you sell the property to apply the loss? It's the year that you want to take the loss. What it does is it has nothing to do with prior or future. It has everything to do with this year. I'm a real estate professional. Therefore, my passive losses from real estate are released as ordinary. If there's any losses in the past, we're toast, especially if we've made an aggregation election, which is why we're careful. If you have a bunch of carry forward losses, we don't want to hurt you. That's why Jeff's bringing that up. Lots of questions. I'm going to see if I had a C corp formed at the end of 2020, is the 1120 form easy enough to fill out on my own if there's no business activity? My understanding is there are fees to pay even if you don't file, even if there's no business activity. This is a sole director C corp.
You're required to file a corporate tax return, the 1120. But there's no fees with it. Well, certain states may have fees, mm-hmm. taxes. I know New Jersey does and Massachusetts does. California, everybody knows. The other fees are typically the registration fees within your state just to be licensed as a corporation.
Perfect. Somebody says, I'm a real estate broker, own my own company, and help people buy and sell houses. I also own multiple properties and manage myself. Do I need to have 750 hours in property management to qualify? No. Just being a real estate professional as a broker, as long as you hit the 750 hours and it's your greatest use of your personal time, you are going to trigger it. And then you're self-managing. You don't even have an hour requirement. So long as you're self-managing, you are the definition of a real estate professional if you want it. So if you don't want to pay taxes, what you do, or you want to lower your taxes, is you take the properties that you own and you do what's called a cost segregation analysis on those properties. And you break that property down from just being 27 and a half year property and your normal depreciation. And you break it into its pieces of 5 year property, 7 year property, 15 year property, and 27 and a half. So somebody comes in and they look at the carpet, that's 5 year. The cabinets, that's, you know, that might be 7 year. The driveway might be 15 year. And they're breaking it all down. The fence around it, that's 15 year. And they're going through and they're breaking them into their sections. And then you can choose just to let that depreciation go at those, you know, like all of a sudden I have lots more depreciation. Mm-hmm. Or I could do a 168K election, which is called bonus depreciation, and say, I want it all this year. And you'll end up writing off about 30% of the improvement value on your house. It's about right. So you can get some pretty big benefit there. So good job listening, because that's going to save you some cash if you want it. Somebody says, I have $12,000 in startup costs. You want to make sure that you file your corporate tax so that you capture that loss. And we'll do it. And somebody says, I know that extensions are granted to individuals. Are they granted to entities as well?
Yes. Every tax return has an extension.
Yep. God, we answered a lot of questions there. I feel pretty good about ourselves today, Jeff. Except my screen is doing weird things. Like it's doing the... What is that called? The timer of death.
Oh, okay.
It's giving me that look. Technology just doesn't like me very much, right? I have a fully depreciated rental property in a high tax state. Can I do a 1031 exchange and buy some farmland in a different state and not pay taxes to the high tax state?
Temporarily, yes. Let's assume that the high tax state is California once again.
Yep.
So yes, you can certainly do a 1031 exchange
you may never pay the state tax.
Go buy some property in Iowa just to complete the 1031 exchange. California is a little more onerous than some of the other states in that they make you file a form every year that says, yeah, I still have the replacement property.
You sell the replacement property and you don't 1031, right? Or is it even if you 1031?
I think you can still 1031 into a different property.
But you sell that and make it taxable. California wants the tax on that portion as though it was sold in California for the portion that was the value when it was sold in California. So I buy a property, $500,000. Years later, it's worth $2 million and I've depreciated all of the improvement value. So let's say I've depreciated 400,000 of the 500,000. My basis is now 100,000. We're just using simple math. We're not adding in closing costs and stuff like that. I exchange it for $2 million worth of farmland. Mm-hmm. California, you have to let them know, hey, I exchanged $2 million. Years later, you sell that farmland for $3 million and you don't do a 1031 exchange. You're going to owe tax as though you sold that property for $2 million in California, and you're going to have the additional million in Iowa in Jeff's example. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
All right. Here's a fun one. If you like this sort of stuff, and better yet, if you like making money. So Jeff and I spend a lot of time rapping about high net worth individuals and when they're doing stuff and we're doing tax strategies. I'm always walking in Jeff's and I do this. He's usually like this. And I go, hey, Jeff, you busy? And then I ask my question.
I try not to make eye contact.
Yeah. He's like, like if I'm hovering outside his door, he just goes like this. So he knows. But one of the things that is a benefit of doing people's returns is we start sometimes asking who's killing it. And you start seeing who the people that like, sometimes we'll just go and say, let's pull all the schedulees with more than $1 million on them. Mm-hmm. And you're just saying, what are they doing? What are they doing? What are they doing? A lot of them are doing the same things. The Infinity Investing Workshop is built around that premise of that the people that tend to make really good money tend to do the same things over and over again. And it's not what you think. It's not like we're sitting here looking at people that are making W-2 income of $1 million. That just means that they got a good job or maybe they have their own, whatever the case. There's what we're really interested in is that Schedule D, dividends go on B. You're always looking around. You're saying, all right, where are these big numbers? What are they doing? Why are those big numbers flowing onto those returns? And so we do this event. I think we have one coming up in March. Yeah, March 13th. By all means, come in and take a look. It's numbers driven, but it's simple as far as building wealth. If you like stuff like that, by all means, go to our website, Anderson Advisors. Like everything has click-throughs on this stuff. So like if you're in Tax Tuesday, just go to our main site. And right on that front site, you have a whole bunch of our different free events, the Infinity Investing Workshop, Tax and Asset Protection. Please go in. And if you like Tax Tuesday, you'll love these things because they're not just taxes. A lot of it is about helping generate wealth. And we like to give it away so you can invite people. There's not a hook to these things. If you allow us, we will teach basic good concepts and advanced concepts that allow you to continue to grow your wealth. If you want to see what, like, again, I don't make this stuff up. We look at other people and say, boy, what are they doing? Hey, look, they're all doing the same thing. I'm starting to notice a trend. What's that trend? What's that pattern? So here's what the pattern is. Like, and it's usually pretty boring. Then you realize, wow, if everybody did that, they'd get similar results. Mm-hmm. So we try to share that with people so they don't blow themselves up. All right. I recently bought a security that I'm bullish on in the long term, but it has taken a hit recently.
GameStop.
Oh, I'm thinking that's a great one, right? Maybe it's Tesla, right? I also sold some real estate this year and realized capital gains. If I sold the security and repurchase at the lower price, could I lock in a loss to offset the capital gains on the real estate? Are there any rules about timing the transaction? Jeff.
Yes, you can absolutely lock in that loss to offset your real estate gains. If you do one thing, you can't purchase that security back for 30 days. On day 31, go buy it again.
Yep. It's called the wash sale loss rule. And it's that security or something that's substantially similar. So if you want to, and you're worried about the market coming back or something like that, you could always buy an option on the entire market. Saying, oh, if we have a huge run-up, I'm going to lose out. but you can't buy an option on that security, and you can't buy something that's substantially the same. Mm-hmm. So if you sell Exxon, you can't go buy Chevron for 30 days. That's it. Just give yourself a little timer and say, hey, look, I'm going to sell it. I'm going to buy it back in 31 days. If you're super nervous about it, don't do it. If you're willing to say, hey, you know what, I'll wait, I'll be able to use that loss on that security. So it sounds like you've had a short term. So you'd have a short term loss offsetting some capital gains. And if it's real estate, depends on whether it's a shorter long term as to whether you're getting kind of hosed on it. It's always better to have long term loss offset short term gain, because short term gain is ordinary and long term loss is capped at 20%. So it's like our long term gains are capped at 20%. So it's always good to have the one that's taxed as ordinary income, unless you're in a really low tax bracket. Gosh, taxes are complicated. Anything you want to throw on that?
Nope.
That's a pretty good one. So I get what you're doing. Now, here's one thing, is the same rules don't apply for gains. So if you have some loss and you want to grab some gain to use that loss to offset, then by all means, sell it and buy it right back. There's no wash sale gain rule. It's only the wash sale loss rule. So it's always kind of fun. I was under the impression that real estate depreciation cannot be used to offset market gains. You are correct, but the sale of real estate is capital. It's not depreciation. Right. So am I missing something?
No.
So it's capital gains offset capital, capital losses offset capital gains. Passive losses offset passive gains. Real estate income is passive income. Depreciation is passive loss. Anyway, we won't keep getting into it, or creates passive loss. I won't keep going into this. Can depreciation apply to investment properties that were not rented? It's possible. They have to be rented or available for rent, right? Right. So yeah, it's possible if they're not rented, but you have to be trying to rent them. They keep moving. Each time I think I zero in on one, and I'm like,
where'd it go?
Where? Yeah, it just disappears. So you guys are too fast. You're typing so fast. So, and our guys are just kicking through them. So let me see if I can find a really good one. I thought there was a $3,000 a year write-off limit. That's on capital losses against ordinary income. So if I have W-2 income of $100,000 and I have capital losses of 10, I get to take $3,000 of loss against the $100,000. So I'd take $3,000 each year for 3 years, and then a $1,000 for one other.
But if I have a $50,000 loss and a $100,000 capital gain, I get to use all that 50 against the 100.
Yep. Guys are good today. Look, we're not even horrible. We may actually finish close to on time. We always try to do like an hour, but mm-hmm. Jeff usually talks way too much. We go way above. I'm like, Jeff, stop talking. Being facetious, of course. All right, I have a escort business. I hired my 12-year-old son to work, and you're like it's like horrible. You're making your 12. He could be doing all sorts of, no, I'm just kidding. I hired my 12-year-old son to work, and he gets a W-2 with annual income about $1,400. Should he need to file a tax return?
I'm going to answer the last part of this question first about, will this increase my chance of being audited? If you have 100 employees that you issue W-2s to, and they mm-hmm. not a single one of them filed their tax returns, that has nothing to do with you.
Yep.
That will never trigger an audit.
Your S-Corp tax return has a 0.02% audit rate in 2019. 2020 is going to even be lower. The audit rate's been dying because the IRS is getting slaughtered right now. The IRS is still opening their mail from July. And I'm not kidding. They're literally opening up their paper mail from July and processing it right now.
So if your son has a W-2 and he is making less than the standard deduction, which is 12.8 this year for 2020?
12.8 this year.
$12,800.
Yep. 12,400. Is it 12? Yeah, 12,400. You think it's 12,800?
I think it's 12.8.
I'm going to ask the all omnipotent internet.
Anyway, if it's less than the standard deduction, he does not have to file a tax return. So for $1,400, he is absolutely not required to file a tax return.
$12,550. Married filing jointly is $25,100.
All right.
We're both wrong.
So one reason he might want to file a tax return is if he has a W-2 and he has federal or state withholding on it. because he can probably get a refund for those amounts, or at least some portion of them. Other times you may need to file a tax return is if he has $1,400 of W-2 wages, but he has $1,500, $2,000 worth of portfolio income, dividends, interest, capital gains, so, he may have to file a tax return.
So there's a good chance he's not going to have to file, but I'd still do it. And one of the really cool things you could do, if you have a 12-year-old son who made active income of $1,400, get that into a Roth IRA. Get that, anything you could put in there, put it into a Roth IRA, because that money, let's see, I've done the math on this, and every 10 years, it's going to double about every 7 years. At about 10%, and the S&P has grown at about 11% over the last 10 years. So, so we're not being horrible, but let's say we have a 12-year-old puts it into a Roth, they put $1,400 in, that thing's going to be, by the time they're in college, that $1,400 will be about $2,800. Mm-hmm. And by the time they graduate out of college, it'll probably be closer to $6,000 or $7,000. And then over the years, that 7 goes to 14 pretty quick, that 14 goes to 28, 28 goes to 56, 56 hops up to the 112. And by the time they're retired, that little $1,000, that $1,400 seed that you planted, by the time they're retiring, should be well over $100,000, which is kind of funny. Mm-hmm. It makes you look at money a little differently, right?
And if he's making less than $12,000 or $12,500, mm-hmm. You don't want to put it in a traditional IRA because there's absolutely mm-hmm. no advantage to it. There's no deduction that you can take. The Roth just works out better.
The question is, I always forget, can you do a Roth with a 12-year-old? I know you can do it with a 16-year-old. 12 might be young, but I would talk to the group. I'm not sure that there's a age limitation. Elliot or Pio, do you guys know the answer to that? Maybe you guys, maybe somebody who's listening out there. Does anybody know that? Somebody says, regarding the IRS delays, so it's normal if you haven't heard anything regarding your paper filed 2019 return still. Yeah, Jeff, it depends on when you actually filed that. But they were opening up, they put out an announcement, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
And they said that they were opening up mail from June. Can you add your son to a solo K? Yes. I'm still looking. I don't know if Pio or anybody's listening, but maybe they're not. I'll have to look at that. I can't remember off the top of my head whether you can set up the Roth for a 12-year-old. Again, I think it's a custodial IRA, but I thought that might be for 16.
Toby, did you ask about the 12-year-old?
Yeah, I was asking.
As long as they have earned income, I think it should be fine.
No age limit, but they might need a custodian. All right, there we go. So, yeah, everybody's saying the same thing. I like, for 2020 and later, there's no age limit on making regular contributions to traditional or Roth IRAs. That's from Doug Schomburg. Hi, Dougie Doug. I don't even know you're rolling out there. Doug's been with Anderson since 1999. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Pio, for jumping on. Good to hear your voice. You have to remember, we don't get to see each other anymore because we have a plague. All right. Can I write off my monthly car payment if it's financed and in my corporation's name?
Not exactly. So you write off the actual expenses. You would depreciate the car if it's in your corporation's name. Mm-hmm. And you would also write off interest, not the mortgage payment. You would write off gas, fuel. I guess that's the same thing.
Here's one of the fun things. Here's the thing. You got to remember that when you get a vehicle, if you buy it, whether you paid for it or not is immaterial as to whether you depreciate it. So its useful life is still 5 years. And if it's over a certain weight, they're going to say it qualifies as equipment. If it's a luxury car, there's going to be certain restrictions. It might be limited to like $10,000 a year, blah, 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 right? But those things are completely separate. But because you have an asset that you're being given access to, whatever your personal use of that is taxable. And people miss this all the time. So it really gets to be one of those deals where I see people go out and they buy the G-Wagon or the Range Rover, and they buy it in the company, and then they're driving around and it's 95% used for personal, but their business bought it. And there's income inclusion on the lease value that the IRS publishes that every year, and you still have to track the mileage on it.
Right.
The much easier way, I'll just tell you guys, my personal view is unless you are using that thing more than 50% for business, and I mean a strong 50%, and you're going to do it for 5 years at least, that's the only time I will buy it in the business, because otherwise there's nasty consequences to doing it. There's a surprise for you. So like you buy the car, you write it off. 2 years later, you're not running the business anymore and you go on to something else. You have now a taxable event to yourself of 3 of the 5 years of the depreciation that you already took. And it's just like ordinary income, just being hammered on you.
You may have more income from that vehicle than the vehicle is worth.
Yep. And you're like, ah. So what I would do is just reimburse your mileage. Get MileIQ, put it on your phone. When you drive around, it tracks your miles. You swipe left if it's personal, right? No, I say you swipe left if the car is ugly, right if it's pretty. No, I'm just, so it, you have a, I forget which way it is, but you're going one direction, swipe if it's personal, the other if it's business. And then if you do a business swipe, like, hey, between two offices, for example, they'll ask you, do you want me to remember that and make it business all the time? Yep. And then you don't have to worry about it. And then you get 55 cents a mile this year. So I can just write a check to myself at the end of the year. Hey, I did 10,000 miles of business use. Fantastic. I got the lowest priced insurance. I didn't put a bunch of liability into my company. I drove my car around. Mm-hmm. And I write myself a check for $5,500 that I don't have to report as income and my company can write off. That's what I suggest everybody do. Unless you are using that vehicle predominantly in your business and it's really staying in that lot and you're buying it specifically for the business. Like there's a, like, so for realtors, it's always a push for me, but I'm always worried that realtors are going to quit being realtors. They're going to go out there and become a real estate investor and they're going to quit being an agent and then they're going to have income inclusion. So it always gets me a little freaky. All right, a few more questions. Let's see. I sold depreciated rental property. I have to recapture the depreciation. Can I take the land value out of the gross proceeds since I had to take out the land value to calculate the basis? It's not part of your calculation at all. So you have basis, which is always non-taxable, and then you have gain. And out of that gain, you take your depreciation and the remaining portion is either long or short-term gain.
Yeah, the land portion should never create depreciation recapture.
Mm-hmm.
So the recapture is only going to be based on how much depreciation you previously took on that property.
Yeah, let's go over it. Standard deduction, since somebody's asking. Standard deduction for 2020, it's $12,400 for single, 24,800 married filing jointly. And then this goes up to, what was it? 12,550 in 2021. And I don't even know what it is. Or 25,100 married filing jointly, I think is what it was. So a little bit of adjustment, $300. Yay. So that's your standard deduction. So when we're always in this weird spot when we're in tax season, we're talking about last year, but we're also talking about this year. So somebody asked that. So that's where that came from. Can you pay your child? Should it be paid through my corp or from me personally? Benjamin, if you personally, you should never pay your kid you personally, unless you're a sole proprietor, then you could pay them. Otherwise, pay them through the company. You always pay them through a company. Mm-hmm. Somebody says, where do you get MileIQ? Patty's put that up. So you can include interest or capital gains from K-1 and passive income on a 1040 Schedule E line 28.
Actually, no. The K-1s are what they call separately stated income.
Mm-hmm.
So it means interest from the S-corp or partnership go on the interest line, capital gains go on the capital gains line, and so forth. It doesn't all get flushed together.
Yeah. So what we're saying is the capital gains in a K-1 can be offset by capital losses from any other source that ends up on your return. So some other business or something else, if it has capital losses, you go and you're going to end up putting that on Schedule D, aren't you? Or is it going to be?
Right.
Yep. So they're going to offset each other. Interest income is ordinary. And so you'd have to have ordinary loss to offset it. It doesn't have to be interest loss. It just has to be ordinary loss. Right. So, you know, I know it gets complicated. I will say this, that if you want to peel that back, do look at our site and look for the tax toolbox. I think for you guys, we've done some pretty big specials on it before. I didn't prep on this, so there's no special today that I know of, unless Patty or Susan has the old one. I think we gave it for a discount, but it's sitting on our site. Take a look at it. It was part of our business essentials package that we sold at the last tax and asset protection, but that has it broken down into painful detail. So you can kind of look and say, what type of income, what type of loss do I have, which ones work, and then what are the exceptions? How do I unlock this so I can use it? What other things could I use to offset a loss, for example? If I have a capital loss sitting there that's going to carry forward into next year, but I have capital gains locked into things, maybe I should sell those assets, even if I end up buying them back. It's like if it's in the stock market. You could literally do that in about 10 minutes. Is there similar mileage deduction for a plane? No. That's a good one, though. 7-year property, though.
And airplanes are highly audited.
Yeah. If you like being audited, we've done that. We had a helicopter company. They were fun. They always got audited because I always think you're goofing off with it, even though if it's a real deal. But you know, usually they can smell it. Somebody says mileage is 56 cents this year. Oh, good. I can't remember. I thought they went down, but maybe it's 56 cents. There's all these 50s, 57, 58, 56. It's all blending together. That's why we need charts. All right. Social media, come in and follow us. If you like this sort of stuff, you can go onto our YouTube channel, for example, and there's a ton of information. If you're a real estate investor, check out Clint, my partner's channel. I think it's Real Estate Asset Protection, but he's linked. You'll see him on our site at ABA, Anderson Business Advisors, and his is dedicated solely to real estate investors and is very popular. Does a good job. Let's see. So you're okay if you have the car for 8 years in the business. Yeah, if you've depreciated it, John, and written it off over the 8 years, you're not going to have income inclusion if you take it out of service. Right. That's always the thing. If it's before its useful life is up, you have income inclusion. All right, so we have a few more. I have a rental property that is owned by a self-directed IRA. Does it need to be in an entity or is it safe in the IRA?
I would prefer to have this property in an LLC within the IRA.
You're absolutely right.
Especially if there are other assets in this IRA.
So let's say that you had a self-directed IRA and it owned $500,000 cash and a small rental in Indiana for $100,000. And that Indiana rental, I had an Indiana property burned down last year. So there was a tenant was misbehaving. They were leaving and they, you know, somebody came in there and burned the place down the day after they left. Who knows who? So, you know, who knows? But the place burned down. If that occurred and hurt somebody, and somebody was in there, that liability, because you would be liable as the owner, would be inside that IRA. And any other assets in that IRA, they could grab a hold of. So the $400,000 cash, they would be able to get to. They would also be able to look through the IRA and look at the plan owner, which is individual retirement account, the individual. So they'd be looking at whoever it is, and you'd be personally liable. So whenever you buy real estate inside of an individual retirement account, you want to make sure that it is in an LLC. If you buy syndications, it's very simple because they're all in LLCs or limited partnerships, one of the others. But if it's you and you're buying single properties, make sure that it's in an LLC. Same situation, you have the IRA and you have the IRA owning an LLC, and that LLC owns the piece of real estate in Indiana. It has a fire, you have a death, and everybody is suing at everybody and they're mad. You're going to be limited exposure-wise to the value of that property and your insurance. You don't have to worry about the other $400,000, nor do you have to worry about it coming over into your personal realm. So they'll take that asset for sure, but they won't go beyond it. And that's kind of the way it should be. Here's a good one. I like this. Say I have 10 properties, all under my name. I want to get a portfolio loan to include them all under the same loan. But I also want to put them under LLC's protection and not in my name. If I separate the properties to several different LLCs, can I still put them all under the same portfolio loan? What do you think?
This question's really going to be determined by the lender. Some will say yes, some will say no. But you've actually experienced this, right?
Yeah, I've done a bunch of these.
So what are we looking at? Are we securing the loan with one property or all the properties?
And that's what, you know, I always say that whenever somebody's getting into the lending world, mm-hmm. you have to realize that there's a loan and there's security. If I give you money, I want to make sure I get paid back. And if I give you money to buy a property, I'm going to secure that piece of property. Mm-hmm. But I don't have to secure just that property. I may give you a loan and secure that property, that property, that property, that property, that property. So really what they're doing is they're just giving you a bigger loan and they're saying, I need security to make sure that if I have to sell all 10 properties, that I'm going to get them back. But foreclosing on 10 properties would cost about $400,000 on average. That many properties would be very expensive. So they don't want to do that. So what they're going to do is they're going to create an entity, usually in Delaware, and they're going to have that entity own an entity that gets all the loans. And they're not going to care when you do that loan, how many LLCs are underneath that, because that entity in that loan is actually going to be secured by the properties and the LLC that owns the LLC that owns the LLC that owns all the properties. So it sounds really complicated, but what they're doing is they're making sure that if you don't pay, they don't want to foreclose on all the properties. What they want to do is take your main entity that owns the entity that owns all the properties, because now they don't have to worry about foreclosing on anything because they own all of the properties. So the same way we always use a holding company to hold all the LLCs, they want to be able to take that holding company. And they know that there's rules that prevent them from doing that. So they have another entity that owns it. And they say that those are the, that's what we're securing it by. So they're going after both. And it gets kind of fun.
So why would you want to do a portfolio loan like this?
First off, it's not reported to your personal finances. So the most loans you can really have, that's FHA, I believe is 10. So if I want to have more lending, like if I buy a portfolio of 50 houses or an apartment building or whatever, I'm going to probably need to have a different type of loan. I'm going to have a commercial loan. The rates aren't horrible. They're going to be a little bit more, and they're probably going to have lots of prepayment penalties. They're going to sell it. So they, generally speaking, they want to put a loan on the properties. They want to have a five-year payout. They're going to have a five-year balloon. It's amortized over probably 30 years. And they want to know that they're going to get that interest. And if you try to get out of it early, they're going to make sure that they still get their interest. So it's always that. So that's a portfolio loan, traditional portfolio loan. Are there other products out there? Absolutely. You can go out there and do a two-year. You can go out there and do a 90-day. You go out and do like, there's all sorts of different private money options. But what you want to make sure of is, depending on who you're going to and why you're doing it, that you're making sure that you're getting the right type of loan for that. So if you're buy and hold portfolio, you want low interest, you're going to do a portfolio loan. And it's probably going to be that structure I just told you. Most of them are going to have an entity loan secured by the entity and then all the properties below. And they honestly don't really care about the LLCs. They're like, go for it. Do what you have to. We, you know, they understand protection, but what they care about is as long as they have a lien against each one of those properties, they are fine. Is mileage reimbursement for private foundation charity the same as any other business?
Actually, charity has a lower, much lower mileage rate.
It's like 25 cents or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. And I can't remember. I'd actually have to look at that. I don't know off the top of my head. I know that a charitable reimbursement for mileage is lower, and whether you're, but if you're an employee working for it, I think that they can do a higher amount, but I'd have to see. Somebody's just asking, do I qualify for real estate professional status? I do bookkeeping for four properties. I'm a contractor, not an employee. No, I have no other job or W-2. My wife and I own three rental houses. We spend more than 100 hours per year. Combined hours of rental property and bookkeeping is over 750 hours. Keep contemporaneous notes. So that would be a tough one. First off, you're asking a very, very specific question. But the bookkeeping for the four apartments, there's cases where they've tried to attribute it to the real estate professional status, mm-hmm. Nina. But in those cases, the person that was working was involved in the sale and of real estate. And they allowed somebody, I believe, that was doing bookkeeping, but it was on the transaction itself, not on the actual, just like renting. The rental really comes into the material participation on yours. You would definitely qualify that you manage your own properties for the material participation. The question is, are you a real estate professional? You'd have to have 750 hours documented in the construction, reconstruction, development, purchase, and sale of real estate. And so you'd have to make sure that your activities qualify under those. So I would say it's probably not, but you might be close enough to where if you spent some extra time doing it, that you wouldn't have a hard time reaching it. Yeah, I keep answering the questions here. Instead of an LLC, is a land trust a better strategy on that IRA? No. The land trust doesn't give you any actual protection. So all it does is changes the title holder. Is it ready to pierce the LLC if the LLC is owned by one person? Piercing comes from outside, Martin. So I think what they're saying is, hey, if I have an IRA that owns an LLC, how is it going to give me any protection? Because it could be pierced, not the inside. Piercing is an outside. Piercing is I did something and I own an LLC and they want to take my LLC away from me. And in some states like Florida and in Colorado, they will pierce a single owner LLC. They just won't give you the protection. That's why you need a statute like in Wyoming where they say, nope, can't take it. So, but that's different. If something, charity miles are 14 cents, by the way. That's good. I love the fact that we have good people that are out there doing that. So yeah, it's a really low amount. So if I have a piece of property in LLC, the piercing isn't an issue. There, the piercing would be alter ego. Like, it's not fair to recognize the LLC. Like, I didn't know, or it's really, you don't respect its separateness. And now if you have an LLC and you keep it filed with the state, you're going to be fine. So that's two different things. Let's go on. Subscribe to Anderson. Do our YouTube. YouTube has a lot of this stuff, by the way. I should go back to that real quick. Go check out all the videos. You're asking questions, and just about every question I could see, there's videos that we have on it that'll teach you how to use this. Do you need to do formal payroll service to pay a minor from your corp, for example? I know that we have videos on that, and the answer is yes. The only exception is if it's working for a sole proprietorship. All right. On a subject to deal, who pays capital gains and who pays depreciation recapture? I assume the owner granted the deed to the subject to buyer.
So this is going to be treated like any other sale. Subject to meaning you're just taking over the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually a payment to the seller. So the seller is going to take care of his own capital gains, his own depreciation recapture, and so forth. You're going to reset your basis in that building the property to whatever you pay for it and start depreciating it from there. And if when you turn around and sell the property again, then you'll be responsible for those capital gains and depreciation recapture.
Yeah. So remember when I said that, you know, whenever you have a loan, there's a loan and then there's a piece of property that's securing it. So Jeff has a loan on a piece of property. So let's just say that Jeff has this building here and he's got a loan. And I still want to buy the building from Jeff. Mm-hmm. And Jeff sells it to me. All he's saying is, hey, I'm not paying off the loan. You're buying it subject to the mortgage that's already on it. And you go, you know, don't tell the lender that we sold it because there's a due on sale clause. And they, you know, they'll get all batty. So sometimes you can tell them and say, hey, you know, we want to buy it. Would you allow me to take over? And, you know, they don't really care it because it's secured. Jeff's still on the hook. Everybody's still on the hook. All I did is took over control of the property. So most times people aren't telling them. I've done that. People always say, oh, you can't do that. Well, I did it. Yeah, you can, right? And usually you have a servicing company that you end up making your payments to. So you know that it's going to pay off the existing obligation. You don't just give it to Jeff and say, hey, could you make sure you pay the loan off? You know, Jeff would be like, sure. Yeah, I'll get right on that. And after my trip to Mars. All right. So yeah. So the answer to this question is the seller is still subject to depreciation recapture, capital gains, and everything else. Quite often they're in a distress situation. So like I know people that do a ton of subject to deals. I've done it. Usually it's a divorce. They can't pay it. They're tired of it. A lot of cases as people get older, they may have 50 properties and they're like, you know what? But I have a loan on it. So they're like, I'm going to sell it off. And it still has a $400,000 mortgage, but you're buying it for $1.6 million and you're going to carry, like they may even carry it. And so you buy it and you're like, wait a second, I didn't have to go get financing. I didn't have to go do anything. They just want it out of their hair. Now it's your problem and you're the one that purchased it. They have the 1.6. If you're paying it over a long period of time and you're paying off their mortgage, all that's going to happen is they're going to recognize taxes over a longer period of time. You're doing them a favor. They're doing you a favor. Everything works out great. Usually subject to deals are good for everybody involved. They got a little bit of a black eye because people were playing games with them at one point a few years ago when everybody thought that all that real estate did was go up. Hey, that's not nice. All right. So we've answered a ton of questions. How is a single owner LLC different than with partners? With partners, you have more than one. The single owner LLC, you only have one. What some states say that LLC protection only works if you have two unrelated parties, husband and wife, they're not going to protect it. So in that particular situation, so like the Olmstead case in Florida is a good one. Brightwood, I believe, is Colorado. But the point was, is that the court said, hey, we're not going to respect the LLC because it's inequitable under certain circumstances to respect it when it's just Jeff that owns the LLC and Jeff defrauded somebody. We're not going to let Jeff keep those assets unless the statute specifically says there's only one remedy. The sole remedy is something less than foreclosure on that interest. So they actually used Nevada statute in that Olmstead case saying, hey, if we had a statute like Nevada, well, Nevada and Wyoming have the same statute. Wyoming happens to be a lot cheaper. So we use Wyoming, but we have offices in both places. But we go there and now it might own the LLC. So instead of Jeff owning it, Jeff's holding company in a jurisdiction where they do recognize it means that Jeff now doesn't have to worry that if Jeff does something and gets himself personally liable for something, that he has to worry about them taking away whatever his assets are inside there. So that's hopefully there. Why can't I see all questions? Because people have their names attached to it and are asking personal questions. So we don't put all those out there for you guys to see because, you know, somebody could say, hey, I haven't paid taxes in 10 years. Yeah, what do I do? So like, I don't want your names attached.
Yeah, these are just questions that are being asked on the fly.
Yep. Go to the podcast if you like watching or listening to these. Both used to be just listening, and you could see there's Jeff and I. There's a whole bunch of other podcasts too. We've had some great folks that are on there. I just did one awesome yesterday, which I'm pretty excited about, and a bunch of others that you guys will see coming up. So there's always good podcasts. You can see Clint on there too. I see Greg. I see Eric Dodds. I see a bunch of Jeff and me. But you can always go in there. Also, if you're Platinum, you have replays in your Platinum portal. And if you want to ask questions, you can always email them in at taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com or visit Anderson Advisors. You know, share it out. Again, we don't charge for this. You can see we're not a big, heavy pitch company, but we answer a lot of questions. I'm looking today, well over 100 written. There's 52 outstanding that we'll get answers to. We answer about 400 questions during the week. We don't get paid for that, guys. We're just trying to make sure that we're helping you guys out as best we can. And so it's always funny when people get a little snitty about it. Like, yeah, I want you to answer my question right now. I'm like, you're not paying me to answer your question right now. How about thank you? Something like that. Anything you want to add?
Nope. I am good for the day.
So what time is it? 4:60? Wow, this is about as early as we've ever finished. So I'm going to say yay.
Yay.
Yay. Here, I'll pop this out. And what we'll do is we'll keep the people on so that they can answer questions and make sure that we're answering your questions. I want to make sure that you guys get exactly what you need. And we will say thank you for joining us. And we will see you very, very soon. I guess we'll be back here in another 2 weeks? I guess these are bi-weeklies. And that'll be fun. We'll see you here. I'll do that. I have to leave. I don't want to end. We'll continue to allow you guys to ask your questions, and we'll have people continuing to answer them since I can see that there's about 30 or 40 questions still sitting outstanding. So we've got people on it. We'll get through it, and then we'll see you in 2 weeks?
2 weeks, day after the March 15th deadline.
Oh, so Jeff will look like this.
I won't take responsibility for any of my answers.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.